recitation yesterday as you were looking at trying to reduce second-order perturbation theory to a set of Krauss operators to show the dynamics of dipolar relaxation leading to T1 relaxation. I just suggested that you look at a concrete example. It makes it a little bit easier. If you take water, so there's two protons in water, so there's a nice dipolar interaction, and the motion in water is that there's a 180-degree flip about the symmetry axis. And that occurs quickly, so you can really model it as a 180-degree jump process. And it is the dominant interaction in water. It's more important than the diffusive behavior of water moving around. And remember that what we saw was that we had an integral of, so the time rates of change in the density matrix was an integral of the ensemble average correlation function of the second commutator of the dipolar Hamiltonian with the density matrix. And so when we say that we want a correlation function, then we're asking, what is the dipolar interaction at two times? So we have a correlation function. So we can write down the change in the dipolar interaction for two times. And then what's the ensemble average? Well, the ensemble average is you have to average that correlation function over the orientation of the water molecule relative to the external magnetic field. And you'll see that depending upon how you orient the symmetry axis relative to the external magnetic field, that the dipolar interaction will be modulated or not by that flip. Okay, so that's the ensemble average. So there's a very concrete, it might be a little bit easier to go and do something concrete than to try to look at it in generalities. Okay, so unfortunately, today's the last day. And so what I want to do is to cover one more approach of getting rid of errors, and then to look forward to how we're going to modify spin systems so that, in fact, we can have a scalable quantum computer based upon this. And so we're going to talk about the quantum error correcting code, which I put on the board. And this particular code is designed to protect one qubit versus a sigma x noise. And so I want to show you in a few languages how this works. So the goal of the code is to return the initial state even given a set of errors. And we can connect this pretty nicely to things we've talked about here. We can say, okay, if there's a set of errors, then we can write those down in terms of a Krauss operator picture of what the errors are. So in this particular case, we're allowing sigma x errors. That's the code, and we'll see why that is the code. But we can write down the Krauss operator. So there'll be four Krauss operators. Hopefully the largest is just the identity, and it'll be the identity on all three spins. And then we're going to allow for errors that are sigma x errors, or so bit flips. about either, about for any of the qubits that we have. So this would be our complete error model for this. Now, the way that we normally think about this is that we've coded the information, the insight into this problem, is we've coded the information into, They absolutely should be. Thank you. The insight into this is to say that we're going to map the errors into orthogonal parts of a Hilbert space. So I'm going to expand Hilbert space and then map the errors into orthogonal parts. And here, these ancilla are going to label those elements of Hilbert space. So the fact that I have two ancilla, which are going to label this expanded Hilbert space, and of course, you know, I'm trying to protect one qubit, so I only need SU2. So I've expanded it to a three-qubit SU8. And that I have two qubits says, of course, that I have 2^2 copies of that particular Hilbert space. And I need those copies because I've allowed four errors. All right, so this and that number, these have to correspond. Okay, otherwise you don't have the space to have your code, or at least as compact a code as this. At the end of the day, notice what we do. We throw away the information on the ancilla. And so I go from having this 8x8 Hilbert space back to a 2x2. And what I want to do is to recover the information in the original qubit with purity 1. If I want to recover it with purity 1, then before I trace out this, it is essential that all of the information be in these blocks of diagonals. So the way that we would like this to look is that we have a set of block subdiagonals. These each contain the exact same state. So I'm going to take a partial trace of this, trace over spin over qubits 2 and 3, and this will leave me with that density matrix. And of course, we could say exactly what this needs to look like. The probabilities of living in these spaces should be exactly these probabilities, right? Those are the probabilities that will take you there. Yes?
The final 8x8 Hilbert space, you're saying you should have multiple copies of the same qubit?
Yes, that's right. We have multiple copies.
Are we allowed to do that by the node domain?
Oh, yes. Yes, yes. We won't violate any linearity of quantum mechanics, I promise. Let me show how it works in terms of gates. And then I'll show you how it works in terms of operators. So we have this state. And I'm going to apply two control NOT gates, 1, 2, and 1, 3. So I'm going to flip these two ancillas conditional on that. So I'll make the conditionality on 1. So it will create a potentially entangled state of that form. Okay. And then we have this set of Krauss operators that say, okay, with probability 1 minus p1 through 3, nothing happens. And so we get the same state back. Yeah, some boring piece. Yeah, nice, but boring. And then there's with probabilities P1, P2, and P3, we flip one of the bits, And so we end up with states. Like so. Okay, so all I've done there is to apply the Krauss operator. And you will remember that this has probability P1, this is probability P2, this is probability P3, and this is probability 1 minus P1 plus P2 plus P3. Yeah. And then we're going to apply the same control knot sequences again. Okay, so I'm going to again flip the second and third state conditionally on the first. And of course, it doesn't surprise us that in this case, we're just going to write them below. We end up with the state that we had originally. It's a separable state in the last two qubits. Okay, and so it lives in this particular region of Hilbert space. Here, we do the same thing. So we're going to flip the first one conditionally on, we're going to flip the other two conditionally on that. So we're going to end up with the state. And so I can rewrite this as alpha 1 plus beta 0 tensor 1, 1, right? So now this is going to live down here. But we see that there's an error. There's a sigma x error on the information I want. Okay, we're going to come back to that. But here there's an error, but it's still separable. It lives in a separate part of Hilbert space. We do this, we're going to apply a control knot, and so we're going to end up here with the correct state again. But we're going to end up in the space 1, 0. Right, so we're living down here, the correct state we have. And finally, in this case, we again end up with the correct state. Tensor 0, 1. And so we end up living up here. Okay, so now we've done this nice mapping. We've mapped the errors into orthogonal regions of Hilbert space. We could write down what all of the elements look like, because we only have a probability to multiply by, except that I need to do something about this state. And that's what this Toffoli gate does. This Toffoli gate says that you should flip this spin conditionally on both of those. And so if I wrote out the gate for this, it's called the Toffoli gate, after Tom Toffoli. And what it is sigma x e plus the identity e minus plus the identity e minus plus the identity e minus e plus, right? That's a unitary gate. And having defined that unitary gate, you see that yes, it will flip, apply a controlled x, apply sigma x operation to this in only that subspace. And now then we'd end up with exactly the same states in each of these, just different probabilities. And when that collapses down, we'll recover the state. So I haven't copied anything. All I've done is recover information. Yeah? And although, you know, you could say, you could ask, well, could you use something like this to clone? And the answer is no, right? Because I could say, oh, let me just take a simpler space and do a probabilistic event that says I'm either here or there. And then, of course, we traced over those without putting them back. You'd lose the information. Yeah. OK. Now, this is a, this contains everything one needs to know about building these up. And some of you maybe have heard of the stabilizer formalism. Yeah. Okay. So you can build it up and say, well, what the gate sequence is via the stabilizer formalism. To me, it's a little bit nicer to go and ask, what do we want to map these Krauss operators in? So the way I want to think about this is if this sort of code is going to work. Oh, yeah. So.
Essentially, what we're doing there is we're thinking is it's alpha zero, and we have, like I can really say, I have three copies of the state.
No. So you can't think about it as having three copies of the state. Because what we've done is to say, we've taken one copy of the state, and with some probability, I've applied an operation to it. And then what I've done is to say that regardless of what, as long as you have a promise that it's one of these operations, and regardless of that probability, we can recover the state. OK, so we don't have any copies of it. All we've done is to say that with some probability, I've influenced the state in one of these ways. And even given those, I can recover it. So thanks for the question. So here, what I want to do is to say, we've got these sets of Krauss operators. You can write down any arbitrary set of Krauss operators. And then I ask you, what should the mapping of those Krauss operators be over the code? And we know exactly what the mapping should be. The mapping has to take us to these spaces. So if I take and really, I would include this one in general. I'm just going to save myself some algebra and put it at the end, OK? But take these operators and apply them as a similarity transform to transform the Krauss operators. And then let's look at the Krauss operators in the interaction frame of the code, OK? And in the interaction frame of the code, the Krauss operators have a very simple form. They map us to distinct regions of Hilbert space. OK? Now, let's remind you of a few things. I'll do it over here. So if I have a control knot on 1, 2, this is equal to, let me see if I can keep my units right here. It's equal to that action. That fully describes the operator. So these are operators, right, that I'm writing down. And if I have a control knot on spin 3, exactly the same sort of action. And those two commute, OK? And you'll remember a few simple rules that sigma x squared, so we write this sigma x is the identity e plus or e minus, e minus goes to e plus or minus, their idempotents, and e plus, e minus goes to 0. Yeah, just to remind us of a few things. It's useful to remind ourselves that E plus Cx, E minus goes to sigma x minus I sigma y over 2. And minus sigma x plus, goes to sigma x plus I sigma y root 2. Yeah?
So you just, E plus is just a projection operator at 1?
Yeah. Right, so E plus minus is equal to 1 half the identity plus and minus equal to 1. Right. So they just project out the eigenstates of the sigma z. And, okay, these two commute, and of course, they're each their own inverse. Since they're their own inverse, yeah.
Is E plus then the same as F zero cross?
Right? Yes, oh. Absolutely. Yeah, so it's just a projection.
Just out of curiosity, then, what's the advantage of writing that in terms of identity plus or minus a
What's the difference?
Oh, no, I'm just...
I don't know.
It's just, you're projecting down to an eigenspace of sigma z, right? It's like the gamma 5 chirality operator.
Yeah. I mean, here, I guess I write it this way because it's an operator. But clearly, you could write it as the outer product of zero with itself, and that's also an operator.
Okay.
So, yeah. Okay. And let's look at the product of these two. Control naught 1 2, control naught 1 3. Then clearly the only terms that matter are the ones that are plus plus and minus minus. So, the cross terms are always going to go to zero. And here we're going to see sigma x, there's identity, so it's trivial enough to write down. And it's worth noting that this is not this. Right? Okay, so then I'm going to take that as U inverse. Okay, and I'm going to apply it to this, and so I'm just to write down K1 tilde is equal to U K1 U inverse. And of course, if we're looking at the evolution of the density matrix, then I would have to have, K1 inverse as well on the other side. But yeah, all I have to do is transform the thing once, right? So we're not going to transform it twice. And all we're doing is applying this, so this is now U. It's actually U inverse as well. And so K1 trivially transforms to the identity.
Yes. You said if we have density matrix, we should have K1 inverse. Should it be K1 dagger, or do you mean K1 dagger?
It would be K1 dagger. Here, I'm just looking. I should be more careful. Exactly right. I'm only looking right now at the spin operators, and so then it would be.
Right?
But yeah. Since I want to include the probabilities, it should be the dagger. Yeah. But let's just for now focus on these and drop the probabilities for a second. Okay. So if we take K2 tilde, it's easy enough to write out. The only terms that are going to contribute are the ones that look like like this and this one. Okay. Yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't catch the question. Yeah, so I'm just dropping the probabilities for a second. So you're right that I should put the probabilities in here. So I'm just going to drop them for a second. I'm really only interested at this moment in saying, how do these things map? So if I look at K2, it's going to map like this, and you see that, hey, we get sigma x, sigma x. This piece is going to give us a sigma x minus sigma y. This piece is going to give us a sigma x plus sigma y. At the end of the day, this transforms into sigma x, sigma x, sigma x. Okay? K3 is going to transform into identity, sigma x identity. In K4, will transform into identity, identity, sigma x. Okay? So that, in other words, the transformation commutes with those actions. That's easy enough to see. So what does this tell us? This piece right here. This says that, hey, under this code for this now transformed error, right? So now we've transformed the error operator. Just like in the average Hamiltonian sense, we're looking at the transformed dipolar interaction. Here we're looking at the transformed errors. The transformed error says that for no error, we stay in that part of Hilbert space. For an error on ancilla 2, on the first ancilla or the second ancilla, we move to a different part of Hilbert space. Right? That's what sigma x says, that I move to a different part of Hilbert space. And for K2, then we move to a different part of Hilbert space. And the fact that these take us to orthogonal areas of Hilbert space is exactly the requirement of the code. And we pick up an error on the first qubit. And if I had included the Toffoli, then we wouldn't see that. If I include the Toffoli, and with the top, this goes to the identity sigma x, you know, trivially from that. Yeah?
If we included the Toffoli as part of that, wouldn't we also have to include it in the left? It's obvious here it wouldn't do anything because of.
And that's exactly right.
Okay.
So, you know, you have to. Remember that these quantum codes work for a particular input state. They are not codes for every state. And so what you would see is that this map, right? Well, this map works fine whether I'm in, you know, this space or this space or this space or this space. It just has to be in one of them. But because I chose to talk to a gate, then that limits the spaces I can start.
Yeah. It limits the space in the
because the input state has to commute with it. So the input state has to be unchanged by the action of the Toffoli gate.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
So that's why we choose ancillas to be zero.
That's right. Okay. So that is the way I prefer to think about it. I prefer to think about them as transforming the Krauss operators into an effective code. And if you wanted to, you could ask, hey, we implemented this code using magnetic resonance. And in magnetic resonance, the noise operators that lead to sigma z, that lead to T1 relaxation, are not strictly sigma x operators, right? But the sigma x and sigma y operators both can occur. And so how did the code work? The code worked because the sigma y probabilities show up just as, have the exact same mapping. Okay, and so it wouldn't make any difference to us. Okay, but you can go through and see that that in the in this particular code, the symmetry of the noise operation, whether it's sigma x or sigma y, doesn't matter. And there's a redundancy there. So that we could have expanded the noise generators and still see the same thing.
This is what goes by the name of geometric algebra, which you
no.
Yeah. You said earlier that we had to have a number of ancillas such that 2 to the n was equal or greater to the number of crossoperators.
Yeah.
If we had included additional noise generators, would that mean that we would then have to expand the ancillas?
Usually you do. In this particular case, you don't, because the correction step actually is the same whether it's an x or y.
How would you?
Then you go through the math and you see.
Right, I'm just trying to figure out the
form lesson. Yeah, it says, you know, replace these with Y and look at the mapping, and you'll see the exact same process. Yeah? So I mean, there's. It's not that an aspect of error correction that's handled particularly well. Just for instance, when the code was originally published, it was assumed that these probabilities had to be independent, that these needed to be random errors. In fact, that's not the case. They can be fully correlated errors, and you see exactly the same protection of the code. So there's still some development work to be done in error-corrected codes. Even at these levels, small things. Now, it is. It seems a little bit funny that we're correcting for something, whereas if we wrote down the evolution of the state, we simply have an exponential decay, the loss of coherence, a loss of purity, actually, to the environment. And you could ask, if I was to write this down in terms of the evolution of the state, how is it that T1 relaxation would lead to this loss? And I'm not going to do all that for you. It's very simple. You know, if you take this initial state, you can write it down in spin operators. And then I can apply T1 processes to it. And if I have three spins that are all in a sigma z state, remember that now I'm talking about the states. Here I was talking about Hamiltonians, now I'm talking about states. If I have spins that are all in sigma z states, then they're each going to relax, and they will relax as e to the minus 3t divided by t1, right? And so what you find is that the signal as a function of time, which is that state, okay, is going to have a term that looks like 1/2 3 e to the minus t over t1 minus e to the minus 3t over t1. It's going to have this structure. So this piece is coming from three terms that look like sigma z, sigma z, sigma z, and effectively the identities in the other pieces. And this term is sigma z, sigma z, sigma z. In the code that we apply, that brings these four terms together with this negative sign. And then if I simply say, well, fine, we'll take e to the minus t over t1 as being 1 minus t over t1. Rather than this continuous case, this is what I mean by a small error limit. over here, what I mean by the small error limits is that only one of these happens and we don't see the products of those. And then we write out the whole thing that you can see that in this limit, S of t is equal to 1. Right? So regardless of whether you look at it in terms of actions by Gates, or you look at it as a mapping of the Krauss operator to an effective Krauss operator, or you know, you really want to be brutal to yourself and go back and look at how the system actually relaxes, of course you get the same answer. Okay. I want to spend just a moment describing that paper on geometric algebra that I left there. And then I want to turn to how we take spins and make a scale of quantum computer out of it. Okay, so we have a set of gates that we want to apply here. And we have a Hamiltonian. We'll take a Hamiltonian that we have as being delta omega just taking the weak coupling limits as having this form. And now, and let me do a quick description for two qubits of control knot in its trivial to generalize. The only thing that you need to know here is this relationship. That if I have some operator that's acting on a state, then this identity is true, provided that A and E plus commute with each other. Okay, that's easy to show. So if I have a C naught, we've already seen that this thing looks like E plus identity. Let me not change my notes, otherwise I'm going to get into trouble. Okay. Says apply a sigma x, its spin is down. And I can take this term. Now, what I would like to do is I'd like to have products of operators. I don't want to have sums of operators. I want products of operators. The products of operators I know how to apply. Sums of operators, I need to now talk about some Krauss terms. So I don't want to have that. So I'm going to replace this with the product of B. All right, so I've simply expanded the products so that I have this nice product of two operators. And given the product of two operators, I can go ahead and apply this rule. And so we have a term that looks like e to the I sigma x b e plus a. I need to include an angle here because I'm pulling things into the exponent. And remember that there's a factor of 2 in all these things. So pi rotation shows up as pi over 2 e to the minus e to the plus e minus a pi over 2. Given this, Well, it's pretty easy to expand it out. And we just do that, just write out the whole bloody thing. You get a phase term. All I've done is expand, all I'm doing is expanding out E plus to 1/2 the identity plus sigma z, and so I'm going to get to another factor of 2 in the angles, e to the minus I sigma x b pi over 4, e to the minus I sigma z a pi over 4, e to the I sigma z a sigma x b pi over 4. And nicely, all these terms commute with each other. So you can order them any bloody way you like. Here, we just have a phase term, so we can drop that. That's that, you know, if I was expanding the Hilbert space, I couldn't drop that. But here, if I only have 2 spins, I can drop it. That's a global phase. This, well, that's OK. We can apply a rotation of 90 degrees on spin B. Right? That's all that says, apply rotation 90 degrees. Here we want a rotation of z on spin A. We can do that in many ways. We can do that by using this term. I could do that by changing the hardware, the phase shift in the hardware. Or I could do it by applying a rotation that is pi over 2x pi over 2y, pi over 2 minus x. Right, you can just change the coordinate frame of that. So there's a similarity transform that does that. This piece, of course, we have to pick up by the scalar coupling. If I'm picking up by the scalar coupling, then necessarily I want to have some interval of 1 over 2j during which that term occurs. But I need to rotate the B spin. So I need to rotate the B spin into the x-axis. And so I need to apply a series of rotations there. And so we can take the gate and directly, you know, automatically reduce it to a bolt sequence. And you can do that compactly. And there's a lot of effort that people are working on right now to say, OK, this piece is easy. We can always expand it out. Can we optimize it? I told you that these terms all commute. So you can see that if you shuffle them around, some of these pulses will cancel with each other. And there's an optimal. And you know, you don't want to use a quantum computer to find the optimal answer. You don't want to use a classical computer to find the optimal answer for a quantum computer. It sort of defeats the purpose. But you can do some local optimization. If you can do some local optimization efficiently, it's worth doing. And there's quite a bit of effort being applied lately to try to do that. OK, so I'll give you a paper. It's very simple to work your way through. But I wanted to make sure that if we have a symbol here, you can relate it to an actual experiment. Okay. So now, I should have saved that for 2 seconds. The problem with NMR is this step right here, which I just erased, that says throw away the ancilla and put them back into level 2 so I can use them again. Right? That's what we get for... that's how we control the flow of entropy in the system. We put the information about what error happened into the ancilla, and then we throw them away. And now we've corrected the state without knowing what the error was, and we've removed that entropy from the system. So the system starts back in a pure state. That's the problem. How are we going to solve that? The way we're going to solve that is we're going to take an electron spin. And an electron spin has a magnetic moment of 700 times, roughly, that of a proton. So I can take this electron spin, and at modest fields, so a Tesla, a little bit less than a Tesla, and modest temperatures, 100 millidegree K. So that's, you know, that's not heroic. That's modest these days. Nothing wrong with having your quantum computer work at 100 millidegree Kelvin. This has high polarization. Okay, so we say that, yeah, we can prepare a pure state of this electron spin. And then I have a set of nuclear spins surrounding it. And there's a hyperfine interaction between these. So let's write down the Hamiltonian. We have a Hamiltonian, which looks like the electron Zeeman interaction. And right now I have one electron, plus the sum of nuclear Zeeman interactions. Okay. Plus two terms for the hyperfine interaction. One term that commutes with sigma z and shifts the energy, plus a term that doesn't commute with sigma z. Comes in as sigma x for the nuclear spins. And the reason that we need to include this term here is that the hyperfine interaction is big. The hyperfine interaction has strengths of tens of megahertz to hundreds of megahertz. So remember that the nuclear Zeeman interaction in high field is hundreds of megahertz. But I'm not in high field here. I'm in low field. So this term is of order 10 gigahertz. This term is of order 10 megahertz. These two terms are each of order 30 megahertz. It can be bigger. That's just the case that we see in a particular sample. Easy to make these things hundreds of megahertz. So this is a quantization axis. Here, the electron spins. Remember that omega e in this case is gamma e b zero. The electron spins are quantized in the static field. The nuclear spins are quantized in the sum of the Zeeman interaction and the hyperfine interaction. And here's the power. If I draw down the Hamiltonian, so if I have the nuclear Hamiltonian, I have to specify the electron spin state. So if I specify the electron spin states as being up, well, there's a term here, which is omega n, the Zeeman frequency. There'll be a term here, which is omega a. And there'll be a term over here, which is omega b. And so we'll have some effective field right there. So this is h for the electron spin pointing up. And then when the electron spin points down, we have these other fields. And now we have a Hamiltonian over here when the electron spin is down. These don't share same axis. They're not anti-parallel. They're just at two random error angles. And clearly, if I want to rotate the nuclear spins around the Bloch sphere, if I can switch between these two states, then I can carry out any rotation on the Bloch sphere. So now I have universal control of the nuclear spin based solely on flipping the electron spin. So the electron spin becomes an actuator. It controls the nuclear spins. Instead of applying radio frequency pulses to nuclear spins, no radio frequency pulses to nuclear spins, we only address the electron spin. But the nuclear spins are going to be manipulated by the pattern of control that we apply to the electron spin. The other thing I have to tell you is that each nuclear spin has, as I've drawn it here, unique frequencies. Okay, so we need to find the right pulse. That's not the really hard problem. It is computationally hard. It takes exponential time. But we're solving it for a small number of spins. And it's an easy problem to solve on a computer for a small number of spins. So it's not a problem that scales, but we can solve it locally. Yeah.
So the electron is an actuator along with how long we wait between flips?
You know, that would be true. We tend not to actually just flip the electron, that we send the electron through some complicated path, and we integrate the dynamics and via that complicated path to get the operations we want. But you're exactly right, that it would be sufficient to flip the electron and to wait some time and then flip it again and wait some more time. That would be that is complete over the solar space. Okay, but it's it turns out not to be the most efficient way of doing it, and so we don't do it that way. Okay, now there's it's useful right now to draw the Hilbert space. So imagine that we have one electron and one nuclear spin. So I have one electron, then I have some Zamarin splitting of the electron, like so. I add a nuclear spin. And I have some splitting of the nuclear spin. And that energy separation, again, is the sum of the hyperfine and Zamarin splittings. And in this manifold, I have some other set of states. And now these refer just to the nuclear states, okay? Alpha, beta, gamma, delta. So clearly, the inner product of alpha and beta is equal to zero. Zero. And the inner product of gamma and delta is equal to zero. But the inner product of alpha and gamma and of alpha and delta, these things, none of this stuff is zero. It's not zero, it's not one. The eigenbasis, same statement I said there, the eigenbasis in the spin down is different than the eigenbasis in the spin up. So as we do computation, what's required of us? It says, here's my computational basis. Here's some other basis that I'm going to use to process information. But I want to get back to this computational basis so that the action I want is always here. So the electron spin goes through some complicated trajectory, and we return it. It's essential that we return it down to its ground state at the end of each process, so that the nuclear spins return to their computational basis. Okay. Now there's one challenge in this. It's actually, I think, a nice thing, but it's a unique challenge. The electron spin has a short T1, short being 100 milliseconds. So remember that what's happening here. We can control the electron-nuclear interaction at a time scale of tens to hundreds of megahertz. All right? So in some nanoseconds, we can control the nuclear spin. On a time scale of 100 milliseconds, the electron spin is going to flip. And the nuclear, when the electron spin flips, the nuclear spins are going to see both the T1 and T2 process. So when I write the Krauss operators for the nuclear spins, for the probability that electron spin flips, that Krauss operator is exactly the similarity transform that takes us from this basis to that basis. Okay, that's what happens as a relaxation rate, that we have some probability. There are only two Krauss operators. You know, there's a Krauss operator that says nothing happens. There's a Krauss operator that says I carry out the similarity transform between the computational basis and the dynamic basis. And what I need to do is to suppress that noise. The electron is adding noise to the system. It doesn't add much, but it adds some. And I need to suppress that noise. And the noise is nice in that regardless of how many nuclear spins I have here, it carries them all through some similarity transform, but not through the same similarity transform. And there's a code which I wish I had time to tell you about, but I'm going to sketch it out for you. Imagine that I take a set of spin 1/2 particles, and I look at the angular momentum as I add spin 1/2 particles. So if I have one spin 1/2 particle, I have angular momentum 1/2. I add, so that's one. I add another one, I have two. Then I have a total angular momentum of 0 and 1 as I'm adding symmetric particles, I'm adding identical particles. If I add yet another, I get two subspaces, one a spin 1/2 subspace, and one a spin 3/2 subspace. And I can code information in this spin 1/2 subspace that depends upon the path it took me to get there, that the information depends upon whether I went through the zero subspace or through the one subspace. And this is a very, very robust code. And so what we can do is we can take this code and apply it to these qubits. Now, the nice thing that continues is that, of course, as I add more and more spins, I get a forest of these paths. And so if I have 9 spins, then I can have 5 logical qubits coded in 9 spins. And the more further out you go, the closer those two numbers get together. So we have a relatively efficient code. Now, in the time I don't have, this gives me a small processor. I need one more piece of information. It gives me a small processor. I can reset it. I can measure any nuclear spin via the electron spin. Everything works. The only thing I need to do is to show you that I can make it more complicated. It's essential that we don't stop at 9 spins if we have a quantum computer. So I take another electron here that has the same nuclear spins, exactly the same, no change. And I add a controlled interaction between those two electrons. And I can do that by creating a controlled shift in the electron spins. We do that by having a magnetic field gradient that we turn on and off. So this looks just like the magnetic field gradients that we had before. If I have two electron spins, then there's a coupling term that is an exchange interaction that is sigma electron 1 dot sigma electron 2. So we have to add that term in. And then via this exchange interaction and controlling the frequency difference between the electron spins, and all of these are on long length scales, then we can couple multiple processors. So where are we? We have this piece of it. It works. It works nicely. We've seen some aspects of this piece. We need to do much, much more. The error correcting code, we know what it is, but in between graduate students, and we haven't seen that one yet. So experimentally, we have to demonstrate it. Certainly, since it works theoretically, it'll work experimentally. But you know, we're experimental, so we won't really want to do it. So we have a path forward to having a quantum information processor that would have some reasonable complexity. Still a long way away from thinking that we have a quantum computer. And we raise a bunch of questions. We're doing error correction locally. Do you have to do error correction between these units? And if so, how do you do it? So there's lots of questions that say, as you scale things bigger, how do you do that? But those aren't today's questions. Today's questions are, can we make these small processors and make them robust? OK, so we have to stop. It's been fun. I'll be gone for a week, but then